Macro Voices is pleased to bring you this encore presentation of an interview which originally aired in full color video on Real Vision Television at an earlier date. Real Vision is a paid subscription video on demand channel for finance. In partnership with Real Vision Television, we are pleased to offer Macro Voices subscribers a free trial subscription to Real Vision. To sign up, go to realvisiontv.com/discount/Macro Voices. Macro Voices does not receive any commission or other compensation if you purchase a Real Vision subscription. We are proud to promote Real Vision because we believe they are the only other financial media outlet that shares our values and standards in financial journalism.
This is Aaron Chan of Macro Voices. For this week's holiday special Real Vision TV Encore, we are pleased to share an interview which originally aired on August 2, 2016, between Grant Williams of Real Vision and Paul J. Isaac, CEO and founder of Arbiter Partners Capital Management. In the current climate of uncertainty, look for value, says Mr. Isaac, in this excellent masterclass segment. Listen as he explains his investment framework and trading style. Now, in the spirit of the holiday season, I also want to give a shout out to something that I'll be gifting and recommending this holiday season and has become an integral part of my investment and financial education. In the era of fake news and sensationalist information, it's great to see a product standing against us. And if you're sick of being spammed with bullshit fear-mongering research as much as I am, you really need to check out Real Vision Publications, which has just launched. It offers quality financial research, original thinking, and robust opinions with 30 brilliant investment writers all in one place. They're currently running a special launch offer of $199 until January 10th, so Christmas has come early.
I'm here today with Paul Isaac, founder of Arbiter Partners. Paul, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
This is a great pleasure to me. And the first time I came across your name was in the foreword of one of our mutual friend Jim Grant's books. And it simply said, to Paul Isaac, who knows everything. And I just thought I've got to speak to this guy. If Jim Grant thinks you know everything, I figured maybe I could invite you here, just be quiet and let you talk.
Well, people who know me well would say that probably should be often wrong, but never in doubt.
So. Right. Well, I wanted to run through your career, because you have a fascinating career, and there's a lot of, I think, really interesting stories in there that hopefully we can tease out of you and let people get an insight into your path through this crazier and crazier industry. So can we start at the beginning? Let's go right the way back and kick things off.
Well, I grew up in the business. My father, who had graduated from NYU School of Commerce, which was their undergraduate business division, in 1928, had wound up becoming what now would be considered a risk arbitrageur in the 1930s. He traded securities of bankrupt public utility holding companies, railroad bonds, bankrupt real estate companies. And he continued to be a securities analyst for a fellow who had a firm that was essentially invested for his own account, but also did a general brokerage business, and eventually wound up purchasing control of a group of small real estate companies and an old, small, very small public utility holding company, and he basically closed out his career running those and ultimately selling them off. So he was active his whole life in the securities business and in Wall Street, and then a number of his friends did as well. So, and then on my mother's side, my uncle had gone to work actually originally in the back office of a securities firm in the 1930s, took some courses from Benjamin Graham at the Securities Institute, and when he came back from the service at the end of World War II, got a job at Graham Newman as an analyst. So while they did not see eye to eye on how they looked at securities, they both were in the business and they both came very much out of the value tribe.
So, as a child, listening to stories of that period in history must have been a fascinating thing to hear, because the memories of that time, which are so analogous in many ways to where we are today, there aren't that many people around that actually carry those stories forward with them. What was it like hearing those as a child?
Well, first of all, like most things, it just sounded like your father's or uncle's business. So they could have been greengrocers for all that that mattered. This is what they particularly did. My father in particular had a very interesting group of friends, and many of them were part of the original value community. So my father, for example, was quite friendly with Max Heine, and actually my father was a director of Mutual Shares from even before Max ran the fund in 1952 until he left in 1982. So the stories were interesting, but they sort of responded to it in rather different ways. My uncle, who had a very strong personality and was somewhat dogmatic in his views, was adamant that buying cheap stocks and cheap stocks by basic Graham criteria was the only way that anybody could invest. My father, who had actually done fairly well during the 1930s as a young man and whose family was not particularly affected by the Depression, still was very much seared by that experience, always was much more financially conservative, probably went through most of the post-war period with a 25% T-bill position, and was much more of a securities analyst in how he approached stocks. So I was actually fairly surprised. I was involved in something in my subsequent career, and I ran into someone at Kidder Peabody who had actually been around for quite a long time. And he referred to my father as the best public utility analyst he'd ever known, and I never had thought of my father that way before.
So, but at what point does the light bulb go off when you suddenly look back and go, well, you know, okay, I'm in this business now. There's a wealth of knowledge here that I need to tap into from, you know, my father and my uncle. At what point does that light bulb go off when you realize, as a young man, I have the history book sitting right here?
It never really did. Really? In other words, in the sense that I knew that they were smart and I knew that they had very definite ideas and you sort of listened to what they said. But in many ways, like most very young people, I tended to think that conditions had changed from when they were really in their heyday. And therefore, while I think they were a great influence and a considerable influence indirectly, I never had this idea that these are the keys to the kingdom.
But so when you came into the business, which of the tracks did you follow?
Yeah, my father was really the fellow who set the template. His comment, and this is in the early 1970s, was you want to invest for your own account, but you really want to be able to make a living while you're doing it so you're not dependent upon the fluctuations of the securities market for your livelihood. So I went into the brokerage business. I went to work for a medium-sized firm that really was, in effect, a wholesaler to other securities firms around the country, primarily in the bond business. And I was there for about 18 years, not directly out of college, but a couple of years later.
And while you were doing that, you know, which sections of the industry were you primarily focused on?
The firm that I worked for mostly did specialty, it was a bond broker and a jobber of fixed income securities. I tended to go into areas that were somewhat research intensive and often niche businesses, partially because those were things where I felt I could get some kind of an advantage, having really no established distribution and in some cases working on new projects. So I spent a fair amount of time in the municipal business, but for my own account, I was always interested in really cheap, small securities, often relatively complex. But of course, in the 1970s, a lot of small, even fairly garpy businesses were inexpensive. So it was a great time to be starting out as an investor.
But that period, the 70s, obviously, I mean, it couldn't have been any different to how it is today. And again, there are so few people that experienced that wild inflation that we saw in the 70s and everything that went along with that. Talk a little bit, if you can, about your experiences during that period.
Well, I think there are a number of differences in the period, and some of them relate to my experiences as an equity investor and some as in my day job, which was really acting as a bond dealer at the time. I guess the first point was that what was somewhat similar is there was a similar sense of the world is untethered from the rules of the game as we know it. In other words, the inflation and interest rates had gone into unanticipated areas. There was a concern that the political system and economic institutions were going to be stressed in ways that they had not been stressed before. There was genuine fear, I think, in the late 1970s and even into the 1980s that inflation would spiral out of control and get up to unprecedented levels, the kind of thing that you'd had in a number of European countries in the 50s and to a lesser extent in the 70s. On the other side, it was a different world because many of the tools which are available now that affect how people trade securities didn't really exist then. You still, for example, had bearer bonds in the municipal market, which made a huge difference in who was going to be able to even trade sinking fund securities, which resulted in significant disparities from what you would have thought would have been fair value at the time. You had you didn't have readily available databases or an easy way of looking up various types of companies and doing screens, so you could have very small companies with really quite attractive characteristics that would languish for an incredible period of time. Everyone complains about the electronic markets and how close and tight and difficult they are to deal with, but they facilitate enormous liquidity even for relatively small capitalization stocks. Often one of the constraints that you had at that time was you'd find something, it was cheap, but just being able to buy it wasn't all that easy. Yeah. Markets were very wide, volumes were very slow, were very small, things were very slow. So that even if you had a relatively limited amount of capital, as I did at the time, you could not buy as much as you wanted to of something.
So we're back there, you're fairly new in the business. How did you find that your own investment framework had to adapt during that time? Because I'm fascinated by the period we've seen the last 8 years, which are unlike almost any other we've ever seen in history in many ways, and the amount of young people in this business that have been parachuted into this crazy environment and haven't seen anything other than a world of crazy central bank intervention, falling interest rates. How did you find back in the 70s that you had to adapt to meet the new demands of that market?
Well, to some extent, one of my strengths was that I didn't. In other words, I made the assumption that the world would revert to some kind of a relatively orderly mean, and therefore it made sense to buy securities which for various reasons people were concerned about. American Water Works, which last time I looked, traded with a PE in the high 20s, for a while was trading with a PE of about 4 with a dividend of something like 8%. Because there were great concerns that inflation was going to make utilities that relied on allowed rates of returns and their inherent lags non-viable. So I was assuming that would eventually work out. In a way, that lack of adaptation, that assumption that there would be a reversion to the mean and then some kind of quality control that the business was unlikely to get destroyed in the meantime, worked pretty well. In many ways, I'm sure you've heard the line by now since you've done a lot of these things, that the essence of value investing is to find something that with which the market will agree with you about the valuation, just not now or not yet. And the ability to have a somewhat longer yet can be very helpful. It's particularly helpful if you had things where people were applying enormously high discount rates because of high interest rates as they were in the 1970s. So in general, the other point about it was not to be too dogmatic. I mean, there was a saying with municipal dollar bond traders, believe it or not, at one time in the mid-1970s and probably for several years thereafter, municipal dollar bond traders were one of the sort of glory occupations on Wall Street. And as interest rates went up, there was a discussion about the guys who sort of said that 10% coupons on A-rated long-term municipals, well, it just couldn't go higher than that. And they were replaced by the guys who said it couldn't go higher than 11, and they were replaced by the guys who said it couldn't go higher than 12, and they were replaced by guys who didn't believe there would necessarily be any top. So that period bred people who were very much oriented towards trading, and it wasn't really until probably the late 70s, early 80s, that you began to see a particularly aggressive buying of financial assets and corporate assets by people, particularly as the private equity boom really began going.
Yeah, when you talk about that, it again brings me back to thinking about today. When you've got interest rates going up, I mean, theoretically, there is no ceiling. They could go to infinite levels, I guess. But when we're going the other way like we are now, we originally the guys who said that zero bound was the end. They've been replaced by the guys that say negative. I mean, how far do you think this can go, realistically speaking? Because, every day I'm surprised by how much further we go into negative territory.
Yes, I always wondered why there was this enormous fuss in terms of trying to figure out how to make that work. And then somebody pointed out to me recently that if you were an unleveraged sterling investor who had bought 40-year JGBs a year ago, you now had a profit in sterling of about 97% on your investment for something that started out with a yield of approximately 1.4%. So clearly this is the sort of perspective price change applied to large numbers. It gets people's attention. The problem with, we've had negative interest rates in the past. We had significantly negative real interest rates after tax through a fair chunk of the 1970s and 80s. We're now dealing with a problem of nominal negative interest rates, and that creates some interesting technical questions so long as you have free flows of capital and foreign exchange. In terms of just how much you can effectively tax people in nominal terms on their capital. Some of this seems to be driven by regulatory requirements. In other words, as long as you have regulated financial institutions that have to match liabilities in some cases, in other cases are required to have riskless assets in terms of repayment, by their authorities that are supposedly liquid, and the only way you can do it is by investing in sovereign debt, which may have a negative yield, there's going to be a required market for it. In addition, we may be getting something that's a little bit like the Japanese. In other words, in modern societies where life expectancy is relatively long and people are looking at a relatively long post-retirement period, you may have a fairly sizable portion of the population, say the 60th to 95th percentile of family incomes, which will have a high propensity to want to supplement their state pensions and are suspicious of financial markets in risky instruments, are scared of path dependency and have some legitimate reason to be scared, and therefore are willing to accept relatively low and even negative nominal rates of return if they believe that in a non-inflationary environment they can count on a fairly steady draw rate on a sum of capital. So the aging of the population, their experience with financial markets and a non-inflationary environment may be pushing people to the point where they may be willing to accept higher negative rates of nominal interest than we thought would be possible. You may have a sizable portion of the population, let's call it from the 60th to 95th percentile of family incomes, who will want to try to top up their state pensions with some assurances to their nominal rate of draw. And in a society where they become a very substantial portion of the household net wealth, that may give you a large pool of very low interest rate savers. One of the macroeconomic questions, which is probably above my pay grade, is whether or not as you approach zero and even negative nominal interest rates with an aging population, whether you actually have an increasing propensity to save on the assumption that people are saving towards some kind of future standard of living goal, and not necessarily for maximization of wealth in the way that we have conventionally defined it. I think there's a degree of heterogeneity in terms of individuals' financial goals, and that may be an element of economic incentive in our society that we haven't necessarily adequately appreciated under current economic conditions.
Yeah, it's interesting because it seems to me that, as you say, that idea that people would save more is exactly what's happened since, if you look at the personal savings rate since 2006, it's been climbing. And everything that's been done since then to try and encourage people not to save and to get out there and get the velocity of money moving and spend their money in the economy, it just hasn't worked. And people have done exactly as you said. They've gone the other way.
Well, they haven't necessarily saved enough to be able to meet their probable expectations in retirement. One of the questions which we're facing is, are we pulling forward a fair amount of consumption? And that, in effect, if we're going to have our current rate of economic growth and future labor force participation rates with an aging population, whether, in effect, we are going to find it difficult to grow the aggregate economy because the average rate of consumption may have to be constantly getting a drag from the effects of that aging population and its increased savings needs.
Well, I want to come back to this in a little while, but I want to get back to your story and back to the founding of Arbiter Partners. How did that? What was the decision-making process there?
Well, I was in the brokerage business from 1976 to 1994. The brokerage house that I worked for managed to have some self-generated difficulties in its principal investments, and I stuck around to try to help resolve those. But for several years, I basically invested for my own account and did some freelance activities. But in 1999, I was approached by somebody who had worked for me when I was on the sell side, who had started a small fund-to-funds business. I was already running money for myself and family accounts and also giving uncompensated advice to friends. So we agreed that I would buy into the fund-to-funds business and replace a retiring partner as CIO, but I would be able to continue to invest the money that I was investing on the side. In 2001, the fund-to-funds business had grown to the point where it was going to become a registered investment advisor, and at that point, it made sense to take my active account and any people who wanted to kind of co-invest along with me and set up a friends and fools partnership originally associated with the fund-to-funds business, and that was Arbiter. In 2006, the fund-to-funds operation was merged with the fund-to-funds operation of a large European bank, which subsequently got into some difficulties. But at that time, we took the Arbiter, which the acquirer did not want, and I repurchased the economic interest of the management entity from my partners, and we set it up as a subtenant of the fund-to-funds business, with my direct and primary responsibility being the fund-to-funds business. In 2011, I left the fund-to-funds business, and Arbiter became my sole activity.
Talk a little bit about Arbiter and the trading style and the investment philosophy there, because through the life of the fund, I'm sure that's changed due to market conditions. Can you talk about that evolution?
It has some. The basic principles, I think, have a continuity to them. First of all, I operate under the assumption that the main driver of return over time has been the long side. We do short, and that varies partially depending upon our view of overall market levels and conditions. The long side is trying to buy things very inexpensively. They're usually inexpensive for a reason. There are problems. Either there's a product transition, or they're in the wrong country, or they're in the wrong industry, or it's the wrong industry cycle, or it's the wrong economic cycle, or there's a capital structure that needs fixing, or there's a management transition issue, or there's an element of complexity and control. And frequently, in a lot of our stuff, there are a couple of those things that have come together to cause the general reaction to the security to be, yeah, it looks really cheap, but what's going to happen? And my experience has been that something often happens. The question is to sort of look for reasons why it might happen on a 2 to 5 year basis, and to be reasonably certain that whatever the business is, it probably is going to have continued reasonable viability over that time, and that the management is at least reasonably competent and not dishonest. So if you can eliminate for those characteristics and you buy things inexpensively enough, you have a tremendous advantage in terms of at least some reversion to the mean over time. And it doesn't have to go all the way up. In many cases, I think we are buying relatively slow growth businesses that have challenges, but if you buy them at 5 times earnings in a market that's at 17 times earnings, If they go up to 8 times earnings, you still have a 60% profit. So it's often trying to buy things very inexpensively. And that has altered a bit. I think we are more conscious now of the, I'd call it the quality of the business, and I'll define quality in terms of its the robustness of its continued earning power, its relative resistance to normal cyclical fluctuation, its not necessarily being a monoculture in terms of the product line or the particular service, and its ability to have a capital structure that can stand some reasonable vicissitudes. On the short side, like a lot of people, I used to be much more aggressive on shorts on the basis of valuation. I've now learned that essentially, just because I think something is incredibly expensive doesn't mean that a constituency of loyal shareholders can't think it should be very expensive for a very long time. So now we tend to emphasize more some kind of either limitation on growth in terms of saturation of a market, or problems that we think a company will encounter as it reaches a certain adolescent phase of its growth and starts to have material difficulties, or a material change in competitive conditions that we think may reduce what often has been an unusually profitable business. I did at one point was pretty aggressive about shorting what I called growth 4.0 businesses, which were businesses that tended to rely on anti-dilutive capital raises, did not aspire to profitability, aspired to continued very rapid revenue growth, and had sort of a cult status. And I have decided that most of those are just too tough.
To me, all I'm hearing is Amazon, which I did this, a similar thing, and it cleaned my clock on many occasions, and I'm now kind of scratching my head.
The answer with Amazon is probably there are elements of Amazon that do make money. I think I question the underlying proposition of the bull thesis at this valuation, but Amazon is in some ways the most spectacularly successful cooperative in history, with very good pay to its promoter and managers. But at this point, given its ability to manage its growth in a way to fulfill those expectations in every way except profits, and the profits haven't ultimately mattered, we're really rarely, if ever, involved in Amazon.
But to a value investor, you look at something like, if you look at this whole FANG thing that we saw last year, I mean, value investors must just look at that and shake their heads.
Well, I think when people talked about FANG, there are differences. I mean, Facebook is a terrific business that made a very successful transition into mobile, but was just extremely expensive.
Yeah.
Google actually, at various points, looked like you were actually buying an underlying advertising business at a reasonable price and making a bet that they wouldn't just completely blow it in an overly aggressive venture capital operation in terms of how they deployed the free cash flow. Netflix was really a proposition on the question of saturation of available relatively higher price markets, particularly the United States, and the need for them to ultimately transition into becoming another network effectively in terms of producing their own content. And Amazon is sort of in a class by itself because it has managed to morph in various ways to guide and fulfill its investors' expectations.
But do you see that this fixation that we had last year, particularly on the FANG stocks, as just a liquidity problem, in that investors are herding into the only places they see that they can make some real money these days, or is this a whole new paradigm?
There are probably multiple causes for it. I think there's probably a real belief that once you attain a certain size in these businesses, network effects and the accumulated intellectual property and talent of some of these very large firms will give them a continuity that means that they're not economically as risky as people might see some of the smaller companies as being. They offer the prospect of more rapid growth than the market as a whole, and they are can be liquidated very quickly by all but the very largest investors. So if you're looking for ratification of a growth thesis in a growth market, you can see why those would be the kinds of securities that would pick up a lot of attention.
So getting back to our previous conversation, how do you invest in this environment? Because it's not the environment that anyone in these markets has actually grown up. We've all grown into it rather than, or had it grow around us, is perhaps a better way to put it. How do you take the principles that you've learned and apply them to what is essentially a whole different market?
Well, I think that there is some risk that some of the non-market rules of the game are also changing in ways that we should take account of. But in terms of the market as a whole, in a way, and this probably comes back to having worked in bond departments early in my career, I do take a bit of a bond swapper's view of life. In other words, I'm earning, if I believe that an earnings stream of a company really represents, or its free cash flow, really represents an available return for the shareholders, and I can buy that on a very attractive yield basis with some relatively firm belief that that is likely to either grow or at least be pretty constant over time, then I'm making the bet that that relative spread compared to the very low prevailing interest rates or very high prevailing valuations of the market as a whole is going to tend to narrow over time. I don't really know when that's going to happen. I can have opinions as to when it should happen or why it should happen. If I buy these things inexpensively enough, I am going to earn a pretty decent return. If I'm really right on the reversion and it happens relatively quickly, I'm going to get to sit for a lot more interviews than this in, you know, much more elaborate venues. And if it just happens at a slower rate, I make a pretty good living and probably exceed the average rate of return for the capital markets over an extended period of time going forward. And at the end of the process, I do think that people get caught up in a bit of a performance derby in this attitude in this business. This business is really about making a living. And it can be a very good living if you do it reasonably well and wind up accumulating a decent asset base. But the idea that your success is going to be measured by being theoretically on top of some arbitrary performance derby or having the greatest amount of assets under management, I think is the wrong way to look at it. It's great if that happens, but the object is to be able to earn an attractive rate of return in a way with which you are intellectually comfortable and feeling that you're doing it in a way that doesn't jeopardize your ability to stay in business in the future. I mean, Ace Greenberg in his memoirs said that the highest priority at Bear Stearns, so as Ace Greenberg put it in his memoirs, the greatest priority that he had when he showed up for work at Bear Stearns was to make sure that they were going to be able to show up for work at an open firm the following day. And I think that we lose sight of that. The object of this thing is to make sure that you are able to have an attractive rate of return over an extended period of time and not necessarily get caught up too much in feeling that you're competing with your peers.
I agree. It used to be that way, but it feels to me like it's changed now. And I who do you lay the blame at? Does the blame fall at the feet of the investors who want to gather assets and want to run that performance derby, or does it fall at the feet of the investors who chase performance and move in and out for someone that doesn't beat a benchmark on a monthly basis?
I think it's a confluence of things. I think people have a natural tendency to chase performance. I think the intellectual residue of the efficient market hypothesis actually does give a ratification to the idea that somebody who can generate alpha, in effect, is a superior investment manager, where that's really, I think, a much broader concept and much more difficult to pin down. I think certainly it makes it much easier to market. There is an unfortunate tendency for investors to chase returns. So if you look at even the best investors, in many cases, it's difficult for them to show net aggregate gains for their investors because so much comes in at the top and goes out at the bottom cyclically. I think it's understandably, in a world of considerable ongoing structural change and obsolescence, there is a tendency to worry that if you got involved in something, either you took advantage of some non-replicable streak on the part of the manager, and therefore it, when they no longer are doing well, it's time to move on. Or alternatively, you worry that somebody has lost their touch in response to changed market conditions. And I think even managers themselves can succumb to that, particularly when they feel they really don't understand a particular market environment, especially when they're looking towards the, you know, longer, the end of their careers. So I think there are a lot of both psychological dispositions and intellectual rationalizations of varying degrees of truth that all point in the direction of making it competitive. I mean, after all, it's also very hard to make a sales pitch saying my recent track record is demonstrably inferior to my peers, but you should invest with me anyway. I think in many cases that is an interesting way for people to look at prospective managers. But you've got to be pretty comfortable with the process and have a great deal of self-confidence in order to do it.
It's a fascinating point, because I'm always really interested by how, you know, the what have you done for me lately attitude. When you look at some tremendous managers that have a fantastic track record over 10, 20 years, who've had a bad couple of years maybe, and everyone's always, well, you know, their funds performed terribly last year, so I wouldn't invest with those guys.
Well, and there's also a worry that if somebody is having a drawdown, is it the sniffles or is it Ebola? And maybe, and particularly in a world in which there's more intermediation. I mean, I joke about having Isaac's Law of Investment Intermediation, which is the sensitivity to an interim drawdown is geometrically proportional to the number of layers between the guy putting up the bucks and the guy picking the stocks. And whenever you do have a drawdown and it's and you do have an intermediary, his client understandably can be in a position of how could you be asleep at the switch and watch this guy be down or underperform. So there's a tendency in an increasingly intermediated market with an increasing degree of measurement sophistication of various ways to make interim switches on the basis of underperformance.
So having managed the risk of the 70s and 80s, the 90s, 2000s, how do you see the risks today versus, I mean, they're different in nature, but are you finding this environment inherently more risky, less risky, or just a different kind of risk that you saw back in the inflationary period of the 70s, for example?
Well, risk is always situational. If you're talking about somebody who is strictly investing their own capital, I think you have a different risk than if, for example, you're an intermediary whose capital is subject to withdrawal, or if you're highly leveraged, or if you are a financial institution which is subject to a degree of policy risk in addition to economic risk. But if we're talking about an unleveraged investor investing for their own account, this strikes me as, at best, a moderately risky environment, in a sense. I certainly think that bonds have a whole lot of prospective downside relative to their upside, or high-grade bonds in particular, given very low nominal interest rates and the real possibility that the current economic excesses ultimately end in some kind of de facto taxation, especially through inflation. But the stock market as a whole is not especially expensive. Corporate free cash flows are, yields are actually pretty reasonable historically. Inflation is relatively low, and there's a reasonably good chance that it will stay low for at least the next several years. In terms of the broader economic cycle, you don't see a lot of the excesses that you normally associate with an economic cyclical downturn. What you do see are more tail risks. In other words, the increasing institutions of trade liberalization, optimization of supply chains, free flows of capital, ideas, and trade, reasonable acceptance of periodic austerity measures on the part of the general population, with comfort in the macroeconomic implications of government policy are all coming under attack. So in that sense, there is a tail risk that is in some ways quite scary. But if you look at the assumption that the world tends to evolve by relatively small steps most of the time, this is not an especially risky environment for an equity investor with a reasonable quality orientation who essentially is looking to preserve real capital and have a reasonable income stream from it.
So where are you finding that value? Whereabouts in the market are you finding the value?
Well, I think in today's terms, I think people are sort of throwing the baby out with the bathwater in terms of some of the financial institutions. You have a number of relatively strong financial institutions that are trading at historically very low price-earnings ratios and prices to book, especially for non-inflationary environments. Clearly, the market is building in a very substantial tail risk of some type of a systemic crisis, or that there's going to be an inability of those firms to avoid getting sucked into the problems of troubled peers. I tend to think that risk is over-exaggerated, particularly for the larger, stronger institutions that have spent the last 7 years building up capital and probably cleaning out a lot of the excesses that they had early in the first decade of the century. So those are certainly inexpensive. We're finding that some large manufacturing companies, particularly some of the tech companies, are inexpensive. We're finding it selectively in various aspects of real estate. We're finding it in service businesses for industrial companies and even for the energy sector. It's going reasonably far afield, and in some cases, accepting an element of complexity or being willing to invest in a family-controlled holding company where we think the management is pretty good and does a reasonable job of building value over time. But in general, I actually think that there's a lot of stuff out there that is sort of falling between the cracks.
So as a value investor, has the ETF phenomenon been hugely beneficial to you? Because it does allow those things, because people just want to get long the sector.
Well, the old joke is the good news is arbitrage works, and the bad news is arbitrage works. In a way, I think that there is more of a conservation of momentum effects in the market. So when something goes out of favor and becomes cheaper, it can be a while before it winds up coming back. I think the asset allocation phenomenon means that everything's got a pretty high correlation on an interim basis, and therefore that can make it pretty frustrating because you think that the market should be reflecting a better valuation of your particular situations, and they just don't care. But realistically, I don't think we would be having some of the distortions that we're having in either out of favor large caps or particularly smaller and mid cap names if there were more people paying attention. And I think in a market that is very much focused on asset allocation with a relatively short horizon, the good news is that gives us opportunities. The bad news is it probably helps the opportunities to persist for longer than we would prefer.
So how does someone with your framework look at, as a value investor, how do you look at right now cash and gold? How do you see those two things? Because there's been a lot of ink spilled about those two particular asset classes of a
well, I think cash and I can't put those into perspective without really thinking about the expense obligations and the liability structure of whoever it is who is making that decision. So if somebody is a true rentier who in effect can live off the income from their portfolio, then the interim fluctuations of that portfolio really shouldn't make all that much difference to them. In fact, I always joke that in theory, if I were investing my own capital, as long as I'm running a surplus in terms of investment income, I should want everything to go down to zero and buy it all with the last dollar of excess income that I have. In point of fact, people aren't willing to tolerate that. So if I think that cash is very important if you have a if it fits within what you're doing for your investors. So for example, if you aren't going to short, and there are many investors now who say that shorting is effectively a waste of intellectual capacity right. for the net benefit that it gives to the portfolio, then clearly cash is the logical substitute to reduce aggregate risk if you are uncomfortable with the overall environment. If you're the kind of investor, as I'm sure you've interviewed, where it's very important to be able to deliver large amounts of money into complex transactions in short order and to have an assurance that you're going to be able to make good of that in order to maintain the franchise value of a flow of transactions in troubled environments, then always having a fair amount of cash is actually a necessary attribute of the business. If you're have made the decision that your primary goal is you're going to try to generate value on the short side as well as the long side, then cash is important in order to control balance sheet risk so you don't have to necessarily make inexpedient changes in the portfolio in response to sharp market fluctuations and under disturbed circumstances. But that you really want to keep at a working minimum. So cash is sort of situational. Gold is it's interesting. We went back and looked at gold, and we have periodically been involved in some precious metals related investments with frankly mixed results. The gold, in many ways, it's very much the Summers-Barsky thesis in the long run. Gold has a tendency to go up in real terms when real interest rates are negative, and it tends to go down when real interest rates are positive. And it's further affected, as far as we can tell, by the relative supply of gold versus the relative supply of monetary liquidity. So there's more of a propensity for gold to go up if you wind up going into a period of negative real rates when gold in the aggregate has declined to a relatively low historical percentage of available liquidity in the marketplace. That sets the stage for a significant rally, which is what you had, for example, early in shortly after 2000. On the other hand, gold is affected by high real rates, and it's affected by people over-owning it relative to their historic preference. Their historic preference is going to be really is cultural as much as anything else. In other words, people are going to own a lot more gold in Turkey, which has a history of inflation and government intervention, than they typically will in the United States. I think that gold is a refuge asset, and when you have things align to a decline in the value of the gold stock versus other things, you go into a period of negative real rates, and you have both a political and a social frisson of lack of confidence in monetary systems, you're going to wind up getting a rally in gold, and that seems to have been what we've had recently. To the extent that central banks sort of take a look at people's money and say it's essentially a gigantic lab table in which we're going to be able to make various types of experiments in order to see whether or not we can stimulate the economy in the short run even further. And you have a situation where you have a number of state actors who are more comfortable having larger portions of their reserves in gold than in, say, dollar balances that might be subject to political restrictions by the United States. That's probably a favorable environment for gold.
So as you sit here in the middle of 2016, and you have capital at work, you have to allocate it for the rest of the year, what are you looking as the environment that you see for the rest of this year? What are the things that you're worried about? What are the bets you're making?
Well, We have a fairly substantial exposure to various financials. They're mostly institutions that have now adequately met whatever capital requirements they're going to have. Some of them are based on consolidation plays in the American banking system. Some of them are just very cheap big banks. Some of them are foreign, where they trade at extremely low valuations, typically both to earnings and to tangible book, where we see a variety of mechanisms whereby they might become significantly less cheap. We worry a little bit about those in terms of the exposure. I think that if you assume that the world isn't going to come to an end, the Japanese trading companies, which we have been in, we were in too early and have been a little too long, are in effect conglomerates that now are pretty clearly decently run, don't have a gigantic amount of leverage on the non-trading side of the business, and trade at very, very low valuations with probably decent earning power under any kind of a stable economic environment. We are finding a number of companies that are related to the energy sector that weren't terribly badly hit in terms of earnings in the current environment, and we think will probably benefit, particularly as either activity or capital spending in that sector picks back up. We have a sizable position in Samsung, for example, which is a cheap conglomerate generating a lot of cash, has some momentum in both its LED business and in the phone business at the moment, and clearly is doing well relative to its competitors in chips. You put it all together, we see individual positions where we think the market is quite inexpensive. I worry a lot about some kind of structural risk. The Brexit, I think, was a shock, but doesn't really have much practical effect. I haven't even triggered Article 50 yet. It'll be another 2 years. On the other hand, it has clearly started rocks rolling in terms of other EU issues, notably this Italian referendum, which there's some threat it'll turn into a referendum on the euro in Italy, which would not be good. You may be having a slow-motion banking crisis in parts of the EU, possibly in Italy. Again, there's this general breakdown of institutional and political consensus where you have a feeling that you can veer in some very unexpected directions. Donald Trump is, if nothing else, an enormous break with the American consensus on trade policy of the last 40 years. I think the market has, for all that people complain about it, become fairly comfortable with the idea of a relative stasis in economic policy between a Republican lock on the House and the Democratic control of the presidency over the last 8 years or 7 years. If hypothetically you were to have a Democratic landslide where you had control of the House and the Senate decisively move into Democratic hands, I think you could be looking at some rather significant changes to either tax or regulatory or economic policy that might have particular effects on various industries that the market really is not taking into account. So I think this is a world in which everyone always says that the 18 standard deviation event that should be taking place only once in the existence of the world seems to be happening about once every decade now. But I think we're in a world in which three or four standard deviation events are, we don't know which they're going to be, but the chance of getting hit with one is pretty good.
So just to finish off, just taking back to the beginning and the lessons you learned from your father and your uncle, what are the lessons that you try to pass on to the guys that are coming after you, the guys who work for you, the younger guys, that the benefit of your wisdom can benefit?
Don't think you're wise is a pretty good starter.
Yeah.
I think the answer is we can't. I think there's an enormous danger in false precision. The ability to construct a spreadsheet is enormously helpful, but that spreadsheet is not truth. There are a lot of unknown unknowns out there, in addition to some known unknowns. the frequency and magnitude of unknown unknowns may have a material effect on what types of risks you're willing to take and how much you're going to be willing to press. I think that in general, I've found that I have to be very, very cautious on things with binary outcomes because I think that there is a enormous tendency to have what a friend of mine liked to call hypothesis creep, an ability to see things where they kind of have to work because that is the mental construct that we have created for it. It's ultimately you need to have the staying power for the gravitational effects of the underlying preconditions to basically work for you. Unless you're dealing with a very short-term event where you can really kind of dope out the particular process, and I think there are people who do that in things like risk arbitrage very well, you really shouldn't overemphasize your ability to estimate the outcome of any particular important event. You still need to be wrong a lot of the time and still be economically right. And if you don't have that in a situation, then you probably shouldn't get involved. And also be very respectful. I mean, this is a Seth Klarman quote, but you know, the fact that somebody is willing to sell the security to you, do not assume that that person is an idiot. Assume that they have been living with it and they know at least as much as you do. Now, that is not always true, particularly when you're accumulating very cheap, very obscure things over time. But generally, if you're in a situation where there is a true intellectual difference and somebody else has decided they see it differently than you, there's a decent chance that they're doing that for pretty good reasons and you may disagree with them, but you really should understand their thesis and have decided that you're willing to live with your own.
It's a great way to wrap up. Paul, thank you so much for spending so much time with me today.
My pleasure. It was a lot of fun. Glad we could do it.